Okay, well, thanks to Luis, Etienne, and Fernando for inviting me to this session, and to be one of the few non-human talks. I'm going to be talking about butterflies, and I could change the title to make it more simple to what when admixture changes population biology. Actually, the work I'm going to present is the work of many people who have worked with me, including PhD students and postdocs. But the work is pretty combined, and so I cannot often pinpoint every slide to one particular person. So I thank them at the beginning, and we'll do again at the end. So I'm coming from a more evolutionary ecology background than perhaps many of you. Admixture is obviously a very important process in evolution. And it's usually defined as a contact between differentiated populations. And this can happen in evolutionary ecology via two major processes, like one being differentiated separate populations coming into contact, like in a secondary contact due to, for example, to climatic events, or differentiated populations over a gradient or linked to local adaptation and therefore sort of permanent contact between populations. And of course, you can have a combination of all those processes, and we've seen that with almost all the talks today. And so understanding the role of admixture involved also not only understanding the history of the lineages, but also the role of selection, niche divergence between populations, and effective population sizes, etc. So among the questions that we ask in evolutionary ecology, when we talk about admixture, we talk usually about the heterogeneity of the different loci, which are influenced by admixture. So which is the proportion of the genome that is concerned? How do we differentiate adaptive and neutral processes? And how do we switch from a tree-like view of evolution to a more reticulate view of evolution? But all of these processes involve a heterogeneity between the loci, and we don't usually try to consider genomes as a whole and a very multi-locus view. So we usually try to find the loci which are particularly influenced by admixture or have a particular role in admixture. So introgression is one facet of admixture, is when you have one locus coming into and invading at least partially a different population. And we have famous examples of adaptive introgressions, an adaptive role to loci which flow between species. Or taxa, and some famous example like self-incompatibility loci in Brassicaceae, where some alleles can cross species boundaries and have a very great advantage in the new species or in the host species. Or you can have a high altitude adaptation in humans or dogs with obvious advantages to high altitude adaptive alleles. And you can have also a role for introgression in speciation with a hybrid trait generating assortative mating and maybe causing speciation. We have quite a few examples in butterflies for that. But all of these see introgression as a consequence of population porosity and population contact and how it influences local adaptation. And I'm going to try to tell you a different story today where it's actually introgression which causes differences in population functioning. So I'm going to tell you about an introgress locus which changes population biology in fairly profound ways, at least this is how we see it. And we'll be asking a question like, why is introgression successful? And what are its consequences? And we'll see consequences in terms of genetic architecture of adaptive traits, in mating systems, population structure, and demography. So I study Heliconius butterflies. Perhaps many of you know those butterflies from the literature. They are very interesting butterflies because they have very showy and diverse color patterns, which are advertisements to predators of their own toxicity. And so they serve a role in protection against predation, which is apparently major and causes very strong selection coefficients. For example, here two species which are very divergent, maybe 90 million years between the two, but they share the same color pattern, and the sharing the warning signal enhances protection against predators. So it's very important for these butterflies to have the right color pattern known by local predators as signals of toxicity, and therefore benefit from that in terms of protection. Heliconius butterflies are also famous for admixture between the lineages, and we have many examples of adaptive introgression of alleles, actually causing mimicry for some of them, but also causing speciation in some cases, because a color pattern is involved in mate choice. So Heliconius butterflies are a clade of, oh, this is very ugly, a clade of about 40 species. And most of them have a have variation, geographic variation in their warning signals, so in their wing patterns. And this has been really the focus of much research on those butterflies. And we know that all of these different patches of color are controlled by different genes and different chromosomes, making a sort of multi-locus architecture for wing pattern adaptation. And this is kind of the toolkit of a loci found across the whole radiation. I'm going to talk about this species here, one of those in this little clade of about 10 species, divergent of about 4 million years, which has a polymorphism within populations, and each of these forms is a precise mimic of different communities of butterflies. And in this case, we have a single locus architecture controlling the entire range of variations between those different wing pattern forms. And we know that this is the homologue of this cluster of loci in other species. And so we have an evolution of the genetic architecture of the trace here. So we've known that inversions are involved in this polymorphism, and actually the different forms sit on different chromosomal versions of chromosome 15, characterized by different inversion patterns. And so we have three chromosome types with the standard chromosome type, chromosome type with one inversion, which is about 400 kilobases, and then another chromosome type with three inversions, like the first one, plus two more. So we have a clear system of inversions which has which is involved in the suppression of recombination and prevents the mixing of characters between those different wing pattern forms. And this is what maintains their differences and ensures that they are precisely mimetic with other butterflies. And so we also have two derived haplotypes in that order. So because this one has two more inversions than this one, we know that this is a derived from this one and this one from this one. So we have also an order of evolutionary history of these haplotypes. So this is the model that we have for the how those different haplotypes control wing pattern in those different wing pattern forms. And the suppression of recombination due to the reverse orientation of inversions ensures that those characters stay together and don't mix. But I'm not going to talk about that really today. But still, we have this clear evolutionary path, but how do those haplotypes differentiate from one another? The problem is, it's actually not trivial, because inversions suppress recombination and prevent adaptive evolution, because recombination is essential in building haplotypes of differentiation. So because selection is inefficient if you suppress recombination, it's very difficult to explain how those haplotypes were formed in the first place. And the answer is admixture. So the different haplotypes have evolved, I'll give you the punchline here, have evolved in separate taxa, followed by admixture. So we have, if you draw a phylogeny of the Heliconius pneumata, so this polymorphic population here, and the other related species in the clade, flanking regions show a very clear lineage sorting between species, as expected. But if you do the phylogeny in the P1 inversion, which is 400 kb, then you find all the inverted haplotypes clustering with a different species, and all the ancestral haplotypes clustering together with a sister species. And so this is a clear sign of an incongruous phylogeny, if you if I may say so. And then comparing the ages of those different nodes, we can prove that the inversion was introgressed from Heliconius pardalinus, this species in blue, into Heliconius pneumata, and then started the polymorphism. So there's been about 1.5 million years of evolution before introgression, and this is what explains to us the differentiation of the different haplotypes, because they were actually were differentiated in different taxa, and the inversion in pardalinus is actually fixed, and so it can recombine freely in that population. And then we have another series of inversions which only evolved in Heliconius pneumata, this polymorphic species, after introgression of the first inversion P1. And so this segment is preserved intact from Heliconius pardalinus, from the donor species, because of the inversion which maintains together, which prevents it from recombining with the host recipient species. So why was this introgression successful? We think it's because it has strong advantage associated with the inversion itself. So if you look at predation, or protection from predation, actually, using clay models, you can show that the standard haplotype form has a very low protection when the inverted haplotype forms all receive very strong protection from predation. And this is because they have many co-mimics, so they belong to a community of signaling butterflies that is much richer, and therefore their wing patterns is better known by local predators. For example, this is what the mimicry community looks like for this inverted haplotype. So it has many, many co-mimics, and so the local birds know this wing pattern very well and leave it aside. So why did this introgress segment not invade then? And the answer is because of a strong genetic load associated with this introgressed segment. We show that the homozygotes for the introgressed segments have a very low larval survival compared to all the heterozygotes, combining different types of inversions or inversion and standard segment, and also the standard homozygote is very good at surviving as larvae. So there is a strong cost in being homozygous for the inversion, and so this introgress segment is great for adaptation, but doesn't seem to be very good for survival. It's very good for adult survival, but not very much for larval survival. We also have evidence that the introgress inversions have captured and accumulated deleterious mutations, probably due to the bottleneck associated with the inversion formation, but also because of the lack of homozygosity because of low survival of homozygotes. So it's always heterozygotes, so it cannot purge any deleterious mutations. So we've seen a size inflation of about 10 to 15% of the inverted segments compared to standard. An accumulation of transposable elements, which is making most of this size inflation, actually, and a very clear enrichment of non-synonymous mutations. I'm not showing the graphs because they would require explanations, but this is the punchline, and you can find this in the literature now. So the model is that all these deleterious effects associated with introgress inversions are due to the bottlenecks associated with inversion. Because you can have in the donor population, everything is recombining freely, so you have you maintain a genetic load that is shared and recombining between chromatids. But if you select one of those chromatids, invert it, and make it very successful because, for example, of a successful allele in it, then you also make homozygotes, all the deleterious mutations in it. So it's a classic bottleneck problem, except that in this case, because of the inversion, it cannot purge the genetic load through recombination. So it's stuck with its genetic load. And we think this is what happened, both at the onset of the inversions and then also during the introgression to the donor recipient species. So we have a great, successful, but problematic introgression, which is causing a pattern of balancing selection by which when they increase in frequency, the introgress segments becomes very deleterious because it forms homozygotes. And so it's balanced against the standard haplotypes, which enjoys a very great advantage because it makes heterozygotes. So the introgression is only partial. So what are the consequences of this admixture? One important consequence is that heterozygote advantage, which is caused by this genetic load associated with inversion, actually favors the evolution of disassortative mating. So if you have an interest in making heterozygous progeny at a certain locus, you also have an interest in choosing mates which have a different allele than yours, to yours. And this is exactly what happens if you do mate choice experiments. For example, the females are here, and you give them different males. They reject, this is a rejection rate, they reject clearly males which have the same wing pattern and therefore the same inversion haplotypes as their own. Well, this is great for us because it explains what actually maintains the polymorphism. And it's also a predicted evolution in the case of it accords with theory in the case of a heterozygote advantage. So disassortative mating enhances heterozygosity, and therefore the introgression of this haplotype has changed the mating system. Most other species of Heliconius butterflies show a pattern of assortative mating with relation to color, and this makes sense in the sense of in the case of mimicry, you need to be like all the others. So there's no reason to choose a different mate to yours, except if you have a problem with your inversions. So introgression has changed the mating system in this case. Now, what are the consequences of this change in mating system? And we're going to look at the geography of admixture and inversions. So actually, the inversions and this polymorphism is not uniformly distributed across the range of these species. It's an Amazonian species, so it's found everywhere here. It's a huge range, actually. It's like 4,000 kilometers wide. And so you have near the Andes, the three haplotypes I've talked about, with the 0, 1, or 3 inversions together. And then the entire Amazon basin is populated by only 2 inversions, so standard or the most derived one with 3 inversions. You don't find the middle one, this orange introgressed one. And then you have peripheral populations, which I call Atlantic populations in the Mata Atlântica in Brazil, that are have no inversions. They only have the standard allele. And the admixture with Pardalinus occurred about 2 million years ago somewhere in the west of the range, where the ranges overlap, and where this is where we find the introgress haplotype, which is this one. And then probably the inversions, but only this derived haplotype has invaded most of the Amazon basin, but for some reason not the introgressed one. Well, not the one that is similar to the donor species. So if we look at the population structure, but this time we look genome-wide, this is the most boring admixture plot, basically. There is no structure, no population structure across the entire Amazon, and the only good differentiation we see is between those Atlantic populations here and the rest. But over the entire circle of about 4,000 kilometers, you have basically no population structure. So this is very peculiar, and this is very different from what you find also in other species of related butterflies, which show isolation by distance. If you look differently at the same data using a PCA, you can separate. So you always have the Brazilian populations here, and then you also single out the French Guiana populations, but all the rest of the West Amazon is completely clustered together, showing that there is vigorous recombination between all of those genomes. And if you look at isolation by distance, this is a very rough graph, if you wish. But you see a very interesting pattern, which is basically a reflection of the same process. All other species show a kind of a positive slope of isolation by distance if you compare populations in different parts of the range, Heliconius haeckeli, Heliconius melpomene. If you compare Heliconius pneumata from the Amazon and from Atlantic populations, then they are far away, but they are roughly in the same range of isolation by distance. But if you compare all populations from the Amazon, they have completely flat or nearly flat isolation by distance. So it doesn't matter whether if you take a butterfly, and it's very hard to say whether it's from French Guiana or southern Peru, basically. So there is, as I said, a very active recombination between all of those genomes, even across very, very wide distances in the Amazon. And as you see, this is a very different pattern to all of the other species. And finally, we looked at these inferences of effective population size and gene flow and time since the split of the populations in a unified framework called GFOX. It's a coalescent framework, trying to estimate all of these parameters together. Actually, the patterns are so strong so that it doesn't really matter which type of analysis we use. And we estimate that the Amazonian populations of Heliconius pneumata have a huge effective population size. So we estimate 22 million. So of course, it's not census size. It's an effective population size. And this reflects the fact that basically we calculate population size across the entire range. In comparison, the sister population from the Atlantic or the more ancestral populations, ancestral nodes, all have a much lower population sizes. So there's been an increase in effective population size in those Amazonian populations which carry this introgressed inversion. I'm going to say more about that, but this shows that there's been a very strong difference in the population functioning of the Amazonian populations compared to all of the other related taxa in this species. So what are the consequences of admixture? We've seen that there's been a novel genetic architecture, this supergene, with differentiated haplotypes controlling all of the wing pattern differences, different from other species. And the polymorphism is maintained under heterozygous advantage, and therefore admixture has caused a balancing selection to operate in this system. It's fostered the evolution of a new mating system, an increase in gene flow, at least at the level of the Amazonian range, and changes in demography, at least as shown by higher NE, which shows that the size of the populations on which adaptive diversity is drawn from is actually huge. So is this we see that as a cascade of consequences. So I put a question mark here, because all of these different aspects of changes in the population biology could be somehow related with each other in a causal framework, like in the cascade of causality. Most of them, I would say, we don't have. We are working on getting evidence for this from theoretical models for understanding how the evolution of a new mating system like disassociative mating can cause in a system like this one an increase in gene flow genome-wide. In conclusion, I would say that admixture in this species has enhanced adaptation by shuffling adaptive alleles and offering new mimicry alleles. It's enhancing the efficiency of selection by increasing gene flow and recombination genome-wide and across a much wider range than in other species. And so we could probably see it as a triggering ecological success in this species. And by fostering the evolution of a very new mating system, it sort of opposes speciation, contrary to other species where wing pattern evolution is actually favoring speciation. And with that, I will acknowledge again the different people who have done most of that work, collaborators in Paris and also across the world, actually, with all the people involved in Heliconius research, sequencing services and platforms, and of course, funding from the French INR, the CNRS, and the ERC. Thank you.